So, interesting passage. Any questions? Probably, if you're like me, you've got a whole lot of questions coming out of that. I will also note that if you're looking at the screen and it says Pentecost, this isn't actually really about Pentecost. That's Adam's fault, and you can blame him for that later. I had to use an old PowerPoint because he didn't make me one. So don't worry about that. Now, this passage has a lot of questions in it. And up until this point, we've actually had quite a nice time up until this point in Acts. We have had the pleasure of reading the account or the biography, if you will, of these disciples of Jesus and what they did after he had died and came back and then disappeared again. We have got to see what the Holy Spirit has been doing through those disciples. We have seen some miracles. We have heard some great sermons. Last week, we had a little touch of trouble. But all in all, I mean, it's good. It's grand. It's going well. And it's been nice. And then we have what appears to be an episode of love-hate just thrown in. And you start to wonder, what's this doing here? What's going on? The guy who wrote this was Luke, not that Luke, a different Luke. And Luke is the writer of the book of Acts, and he's the one that's bringing all these stories together. And I've mentioned this before. When we're reading something like this, we start to wonder, well, why did Luke choose this? Why did he choose to put this story in the book of Acts, and why did he choose to put it here? I mean, Acts isn't a Dear Diary account of the life of the disciples. It's not a daily account of what's going on. It's a collection of stories, but it's over a period of something like 30 years. So there's things that Luke decided not to put in, and there's things that he decided to put in. He decided to put this in. Why? Why did he put this in? I mean, I don't know, did nobody tell Luke that he wasn't writing an Old Testament book? I mean, did he know that this was a New Testament book? I start to wonder, did he have an editor or a proofreader? And if he had an editor or a proofreader, I think they probably would have circled this and kind of went, this is Old Testament, Luke, wrong place. Get back into the New Testament. Can we not just stick with the grace and the love and the miracles and the happiness for a little bit longer? I don't think we need to just start spoiling it by telling people about God judging people and killing people, do we? I mean, here's the scary bit. Here's the scary bit. He's not even judging the pagans outside the church. He's judging and killing people who come to church, regularly come to church, and give money to the church. Jenny, Mac, look, I mean, this isn't the story that's going to encourage anyone to come along. What's he playing at? I think Luke knows. I think Luke knows what he wants to do. I think Luke knows that the God of the Old Testament is exactly the same God that we have today, exactly the same God of the New Testament. This is something that a lot of people question today. But he is. He's exactly the same. And we know this because God himself tells us in Malachi, in a book in the Old Testament, at the end of the Old Testament, God says, I am the Lord, I do not change. I am the Lord, I do not change. Does God show his holiness and judgment in the Old Testament? Yes. Does God show his mercy and grace and love in the New Testament? Yes. Does God show his holiness and judgment in the New Testament? Yes. And does God show his mercy and grace and love in the Old Testament? Yes. He's exactly the same God. It's a ridiculous notion to think that these Old Testament heroes of faith that we have, that these guys were actually just really good people. They were so great that they made it to God themselves. Well, they didn't. God made it to them. Those guys weren't amazingly great people. God made them great. They were murderers. They were liars. They were thieves. They were cheaters. But God used them. God showed them his love and his grace and used them. I think we have to move past this kind of simple categories of Old Testament God bad, New Testament God good. The Bible is much more complex than that because life is much more complex than that. I am the Lord, I do not change. So God's the same. Same in the old, same in the new, same today. But let's backpedal a bit. So we have this story of Ananias and Sapphira. I'm probably going to mispronounce their names a couple of times. I'm probably going to change how I pronounce them throughout this. Don't worry about that. I just hope I don't call her Shakira at any point. We haven't met them before this, and they're not going to be around for too long. But there's an important reason why we made sure that Karen read the end of chapter 4 with this story. Because out of context, this story is just completely nuts. But in context, this story is just slightly nuts. And it makes just a little bit more sense. So the end of chapter 4, we meet Joseph, who the gang are calling Barnabas. And we'll meet Barnabas quite a few times throughout Acts as we go on. We'll see him again. Now, why are they calling him Barnabas? It's not his name. I don't even think it's his confirmation name. So why call him Barnabas? Well, Barnabas, as we read in verse 36, means son of encouragement. So clearly Barnabas is quite well received. People must like him. He must be quite encouraging. So where do they get this from? Well, we read that he has sold a field that he owned and that he has given all the money to the community. So he sold a field, sold some of his possessions, and he's given that money to the community. That's encouraging. Note, it doesn't say that he sold his only field. It doesn't say that he sold all his possessions. But nonetheless, he's made a significant personal sacrifice for the community. And the people like him. And he's now known as Barnabas, son of encouragement. Now, Barnabas isn't the only one sharing what he has. In verse 32 of chapter 4, we read that everyone shared everything. In fact, we read that no one claimed any of their possessions as their own, which is pretty amazing. So why are people doing this? Well, middle of verse 33, God's grace was so powerfully at work in them all that there was no needy persons among them. It's God's grace. Why are they doing this? God's grace at work in them. Grace has implications. Grace leads us somewhere. Grace creates a human connection and community, one grounded in real needs being met by real people in real ways. Grace changes us, changes what we do, changes how we live. It's the knowledge of, the understanding of, and the feeling of God's grace that has driven this community to sharing everything with each other. And I think we wouldn't be too far wrong to assume that the same goes for Barnabas, that he has a knowledge of, an understanding of God's grace, and that has led him to selling his field and giving the money to this community. Now, a man named Ananias, verse 1, chapter 5. Right at the start of this story, Luke gives us a huge clue that the stories are connected. Okay, so the last thing we talk about in chapter 4 is Barnabas and his gift of money and the significant sacrifice that he made for the community. And suddenly, we bring in Ananias and Sapphira. And they're part of this community as well. And they're actually doing something very similar to Barnabas. They have some property, and they sell the property, and they give the money to the community. It's very, very similar, except there's a huge chasm between the attitude of Barnabas and the attitude of Ananias and Sapphira. Ananias and Sapphira would have been appreciated and thanked if they had made a donation, even if they had kept 30% or 50% or 80% of the money to themselves. It's not about the money. Nowhere in this text do we get the feeling that it's about the money. Nowhere in this passage do we see the slightest glimpse of greed on the part of the church leaders. The problem isn't the money, the problem is the dishonesty. They pretend like they're giving it all. They pretend they're giving everything. Why would they do that? So that they can look better. Maybe people would view them like Barnabas. Maybe they would get a name like Son of Encouragement. The thing is, they don't want to make the sacrifice that Barnabas made. They just want the esteem. And the ironic thing is, I think, it's just a guess, but I think probably Barnabas didn't want the esteem and just wanted to make the sacrifice. Because of his understanding of God's grace. So Ananias and Sapphira are pretending to do good while committing a very selfish act here. And as we find out, nothing will kill the life of a community faster than pretending. Which brings us to the difficult issue of God striking people dead. The first thing I want to throw out there, I'm just going to throw this out there. Nowhere in the text does it actually say God killed them. We read that into it. Nowhere in the text does it say that he killed them. Albeit it says they died immediately after Peter spoke to them. But maybe this is just a coincidence. Misunderstanding. Just good timing or bad timing. I don't really believe that. It doesn't say that God killed them directly in the text. Although, as I've already said to you, Luke wrote this book. And Luke is a doctor by trade. If anyone would have had an interest or an ability to ascertain what had actually happened to these people, I think Dr. Luke might have had an interest and ability to ascertain that. But he doesn't even make an attempt to explain it. He just leaves it there. He might not openly say that God struck them down, but he certainly heavily implies it. And whatever the cause, the important thing is that the church at the time, the people who are there, they see it as God's judgment on the couple. They understand it as God's judgment on the couple. So if God killed them, then why did he kill them? We've already said it's not about the money. Okay? So it's not about the money. It's because they lied, right? I mean, Peter says it. Peter says they lied to the Holy Spirit. But I'm going to be honest and say that this whole thing still makes me feel a little bit uncomfortable. I mean, it all seems a little bit harsh. Do Ananias and Sapphira get killed because they lied? Other people have lied. Adam and Eve. Liars. Abraham, he lied a lot, lied all the time. Jacob, Isaac, David, loads of people have lied. And get this, the person who is voicing the judgment on them is Peter. Peter. The guy who, when things got tough and Jesus was heading to the cross, repeatedly told people that he didn't know Jesus, even though he did know Jesus. This is that guy. Peter. The guy who clearly lied before. Loads of people have lied. So are this couple getting killed because they lied? The whole thing makes me a bit uncomfortable. It also makes me a bit uncomfortable because I look at my own life and I think, well, if he's going to kill them, because for that, I mean, why am I still breathing? I mean, if that's judgment that's passed on to them, what... Oh, has he just not got round to me yet? I mean, what's going on? In some ways, I don't think it's for me to question the ways of God. God will do what God will do. And in my eyes, what I see may seem harsh to me, but maybe from a different point of view, I could see an abundance of grace and mercy and love shown to all those who have lied before, all those who continue to lie to the church, to the Holy Spirit, who have been forgiven time after time after time, again and again. The abundance of grace and mercy and love that God has shown. But why Ananias and Sapphira? Why did they get killed? Honestly, any answer I give you is a guess. At this point in time, I would even go as far as to say it would be completely fruitless to try and narrow down this story to a list of things to avoid doing unless you want to end up like Ananias and Sapphira. I don't think Luke is giving us a list of things to avoid doing at this point. At the end of the day, is it really smart to try and make God operate according to my very limited wisdom and understanding? At the start of the book, I questioned why Luke would record such a story and put it in here. And I don't think he's putting it in here so that we have a list of things to avoid. I think we can answer why he has put it in here. And I think it's because Luke has told us a couple of times throughout the passage. He's already told us twice, once in the middle and once at the end. I think, in particular, Luke is writing to us and including this story because it has everything to do with our attitude towards God. In particular, our fear of God, or to use an Old Testament term, the fear of the Lord. When we go to the Old Testament, the fear of the Lord is a common enough term that is used there. But we come up with some very puzzling and odd pictures of what that looks like. One of the things that comes up is that the more forgiveness and grace you know, the more you will fear the Lord. Seems odd. We also find out that fearing the Lord will bring you great joy. We're also told that you can be taught to fear the Lord and that you can grow in fear of the Lord. And surely, if anything, if you know you're forgiven, you'd think that would decrease your fear rather than increasing it, because you know that you're safe, that you've been forgiven, that your past has been let go of. But the Old Testament seems to tell us that fearing the Lord is less to do with actually being scared and more to do with our relationship with God. To fear the Lord is to be overwhelmed with wonder and greatness of how great God is and his love is. Fearing him means that we don't ignore his voice. Fearing him means we don't ignore his commands, because we recognize how holy and right he is and how selfish and wrong we can be. Fearing him means that we don't ignore what Jesus has done and the consequences that it has for our life. Fearing him means bowing before him out of amazement of his glory and his beauty. And that is why the more that we experience God's grace and forgiveness, the more we experience a trembling awe and wonder before the greatness of all that he has done for us. The book of Proverbs repeatedly tells us that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of all wisdom. Fear of the Lord is the beginning of all wisdom. And that's why I think the last verse of this story is significant. Great fear seized the whole church and all who heard about these events. Great fear seized the whole church. And there we have it. The very first time the word church is used in the book of Acts. As the church begins, it learns to fear the Lord. Because the fear of the Lord is the beginning of all wisdom. I think the band are going to come back up again and sing. And while they do that, may we sing our praise to the God of Abraham, Moses, and David. May we worship the God of yesterday, today, and tomorrow. May we be full of God's grace, leading us to meet real people's needs in real ways. May we be honest, not pretending or prideful. May our reputation take last place and let God's glory sit in pole position. And may we be God-fearing, having a fear of displeasing God that comes from a knowledge of how right he is and the consequences of how wrong we can be.